This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Stay tuned for the Butte Report. Welcome to the Butte Report. It is Thursday, February 11th, 2021. The Butte Report is a weekly program reporting on and analyzing issues that affect our lives and our livelihood by focusing on local government, including the Board of Supervisors, the various municipalities, and even school boards and water districts within Butte County. I'm your host, Sue Hildebrand. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by John Burge, a certified public accountant providing tax services in Chico since 1975. John is a proud supporter of community radio, and he's current in the new 2021 tax laws, offering tax preparation, including e-filing at 17 Williamsburg Lane in the Stonebridge Professional Village. John Burge, CPA, can be reached at 342-3680 and at johnburgecpa.com. Tonight on the Butte Report, we'll cover the Butte County Board of Supervisors meeting, the Oroville City Council's exploration of fire services, and the Palermo School District reopening negotiations. At the Butte County Board of Supervisors meeting on Tuesday, the board agenda included appointments to the Water Commission and a presentation by the Town of Paradise about the possible multi-million dollar wastewater pipeline that would run from Paradise down to Chico. First, the Water Commission. In split votes, Mark Grover was reappointed to the Water Commission, and newly appointed members to the commission include Fred Montgomery, Donnie Stinnett, and Ernie Washington. The Butte County Water Commission acts as an advisory committee to the Board of Supervisors on water policy, and these appointments have historically been non-controversial. This changed back in August when the board rejected Supervisor Tammy Ritter's nominee after placing new requirements on the application process that were inconsistent with norms. For these recent appointments, both Supervisor Ritter and Supervisor Deborah Lucero voted no on these candidates because the more strenuous application requirements were absent this time around. When asked about her concerns with respect to process, Deborah Lucero said,
"My concern is that when Supervisor Ritter wanted to appoint her water commissioner, she was unable to do that. We could not get the votes. And the process at that point, as she pointed out, was broken. We were not requiring resumes or letters of interest. It's been very casual, and yet this body is a recommending body to the Board of Supervisors and carries a lot of sway. They come up with resolution language. They are the first ones and oftentimes the only ones who get in-depth briefings on water issues that then come up to the Board of Supervisors in an abbreviated form. So the people that sit on that commission are very important. So I don't know how these things are decided, but they're decided before we ever sit down."
The Town of Paradise's Disaster Recovery Director, Katie Simmons, gave a presentation to the board about a proposed pipeline that would carry wastewater from Paradise to the Chico Wastewater Treatment Plant. This project, as well as the proposed water pipeline that would carry Paradise Irrigation District water to Chico, has been on the agenda and discussed by at least five different local government agencies in the last few weeks. Supervisor Lucero was concerned by the seeming lack of transparency of this project, as well as the unknown costs associated with a project of this scale.
"Oh, something that came out of that is I asked Katie Simmons whether this was the first step, as we have been told by Assemblyman Gallagher that this is the first step. And in fact, it is not the first step. A feasibility study was done. It was done entirely on the ridge and between state officials and the Town of Paradise. No local official that I'm aware of was involved. No elected official was involved. And we are now squarely in the EIR phase of this project. So my concern at the county level was, how much is this going to cost the county just to study it? It's the 12th largest infrastructure project in the state of California. That's how it was described to us. And we can barely keep up with building permits. We hire outside consultants for that. How are we going to do an EIR on a project of that size?
The Board of Supervisors meets on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month. The next meeting is scheduled for February 23rd at 9 a.m. Meetings can be watched online. You are listening to the Butte Report on KZFR Radio. Turning to the city of Oroville, 2 weeks ago in a special session, Cal Water was invited to present a proposal to take over fire services currently being provided by the Oroville Fire Department. Last week at the regular meeting, Deputy Fire Chief Chris Tins presented the Oroville Fire Department's five-year plan. The council directed staff to present the two proposals in a way that made the proposals easier to compare. I spoke with the Oroville City Administrator, Bill Legrone, and started by asking him to explain why the city is considering replacing the Oroville Fire Department with Cal Fire for the city's fire services.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time and the opportunity to educate everyone about what the facts are behind the situation, as opposed to running with what they may have heard or what they think may be going on. What's went on in the city of Oroville for the past decade or more is that we've had a severe shortage of revenue. In 2018, the citizens of the city of Oroville approved a 1% sales tax that could be used to offset the revenue shortfalls of the city. And that was approved in November of 2018. In April of 2019, the tax actually went into effect. So we were beginning to see some results of the Measure U, the 1% sales tax. Well, September of 2019, you know, the city was still in a significant financial crisis. So we were looking at ways to address our revenue shortfalls. And one of those ways was to look and see what would be the cost of contracting out our fire services. So in September of 2019, we released an RFP. Well, everybody knows what happened after 2019. 2020 happened. And if it wasn't for a catastrophe, you know, we had a pandemic. I mean, it was one thing after another. It took a considerable amount of time for the RFP process to be conducted and for the initial proposal to come back from Cal Fire. We did receive that proposal in November of 2020. So why it seems like there's such a large separation is just the things that happened and the financial crisis that the city was under. And there's still the PERS crisis that the city and all cities are suffering from still drives the issue.
Bill Legrone, outside of the council meetings, you have personally been comparing the plans offered by Cal Fire as well as the plan that was offered by the Oroville Fire Department. From this early stage, how do you compare the services that are being offered by both of those agencies?
Well, I think we have to start with the quality of the service. And I'll be the first one to tell you, Oroville Fire has top quality fire personnel. They are very good at what they do. They're very efficient at what they do. This is not about any referendum or comment on their ability or anything. Cal Fire also has high quality people. So, you know, going into it, the first thing you would compare is quality. It's of comparable quality between both sides. What I'm looking at is what is the long-term financial impact to the community of Oroville. You know, we don't, when you're trying to manage a city, you aren't managing for today or tomorrow. You're managing for the next 20 years. And what are the choices and decisions that we make today that is going to affect our community 20 years from now? So you have to do a comparative analysis of that, is what is the long-term financial impact. One of the long-term financial impacts that is significant on this is what is our CalPERS financial unfunded liability responsibility. CalPERS, every city carries unfunded liability. Right now, the city of Oroville carries about $16.5 million of unfunded liability for CalPERS classic employees. The only way that we can control what that number is by how much we add to our principal each year. The only way to reduce what you're adding to your principal is to reduce the number of employees that you are, the employer is responsible for. So the only control that this community would have in controlling what PERS does or what PERS doesn't do, which what they have been doing, is underperforming, and which causes our overall unfunded liability to continue to rise. Now, I want to be really clear, Sue, with everybody, that our unfunded liability is going to continue to rise as long as PERS does not reach their yearly investment goals. They typically are setting their goals at 7%. Last year, they achieved 4.7%, which causes our discount rating to change, which causes our unfunded liability long-term to go up. An example of that would be is in last year, we paid $2 million to pay down our unfunded liability. Well, we owed at the time overall for everybody about $22 million. Now, one would think that if you pay $2 million toward the principal to attack the principal and drive the cost down, that you would owe $20 million. At the end of last year, we owed $25 million. So what's driving that is the underperformance of PERS. So what this community has to do is make hard and tough decisions about how do we address that? I mean, because now, sure, we can handle that today and we can handle that for the next 5 or 10 years. But what happens after that? If PERS continues to underperform, we, this community, Oroville and Chico and every other community, bears the burden of that. So we have to look at ways of how to address that. So one of the significant comparative points of this analysis will be, what is the long-term financial impact? Now, on the positive, the other side, you know, what do you give up? What do you lose? Do you lose local control? Do you lose, you know, high-quality fire personnel? Do you lose all that experience you have, that institutional knowledge? Do you lose your own community, I mean, in your fire department? Now, there is a cost you do pay. As far as local control, we will lose some control of our fire department because we will be contracting, if the council does this, with an outside service. So the outside service will ultimately have control of that service. What the council will exercise control of is the size of the service, the cost of the service that we're willing to pay, and also they will be have a chief that is assigned to this community, responsible to this council, that has to be responsive to this council. So they will have some of that control. Local identity, we're trying to do everything we can not to lose that. A couple of those things that we've been insistent upon in our RFP is that we retain our buildings. We retain our equipment, and we retain the look of our equipment. I mean, we don't want anything to change. What we ideally would like to achieve if we do this is that the average person driving past the firehouse has no idea this even happened. One of the important aspects of our RFP was to retain our employees. We want our employees working at that firehouse just like they always have. That's part of the seamless transition so that it doesn't cause people discomfort because all of a sudden, hey, there's all new faces. There's different looking trucks down there. They're doing things differently. So we're trying to keep our identity, keep that institutional knowledge that exists, but then also take the financial long-term debt and put that with the state as opposed to keeping it here locally.
That was Oroville City Administrator Bill Legrone. The council will pick up the issue again next Tuesday, February 16th, at its regular meeting and may decide whether to continue funding the local Oroville Fire Department or to contract out to fire services with the state Cal Fire. to schools during COVID-19. Last night at the Oroville Elementary School Board meeting, Superintendent Spencer Holtum updated the board on the district's current hybrid learning model and reported on the findings of two surveys. The teachers' union survey showed that 75% of teachers want to remain in hybrid mode. Holtum reported that in the survey for parents, the verbiage was considered misleading, and a new online survey launched this past Monday. As a result, the sample size for the parent survey was too small at the time of the meeting to be considered conclusive. The school board ultimately decided to revisit the issue at its next meeting on March 11th so they could review the COVID numbers and the parent survey results. Last week, the Chico Unified School District voted to continue with the AMPM model of instruction through the current school year. A school district that uses the AMPM hybrid model is considered to be open. Another school district discussing their educational model is the Palermo School District. The community of Palermo, which lies due south of Oroville, has a population of around 5,500 people. Like other school districts, the Palermo School Board is working to balance quality education with the safety of its teachers, staff, and students. However, unlike other school boards, the Palermo School Board is using what is called interest-based bargaining that includes the school board and the teachers' union to come up with a solution that satisfies the most people. I spoke with Palermo School Board member Bill Bynum, who is also on the negotiation team, and started by asking him how the interest-based bargaining is different than a school board simply discussing an issue and then voting.
Yeah, well, when the state went to collective bargaining with unions and their employers, the school boards, back in the 70s, it was chaotic and it was adversarial, and there were a lot of walkouts, a lot of strikes, a lot of work to rules. And eventually in the 90s, somebody came up with the idea of, let's see if we can't get the parties to start off with the same goals in mind. And then they came up with what is called interest-based bargaining. And what that means is each side looks at the issues from the other side's point of view. And so when you go to the table, you go to the table first off with the goal of understanding each other. And so you start off by listing your interest, and then you match your interests with the other side's interest and come up with common interests. So, for instance, you both want the district to be solvent. You both want the kids to get the best education possible. You both want to attract the best people possible. So you list all your common interests. And if there are a couple that clash, you set them aside and you're going to work on those. So it's a collaborative effort. It's long, it's arduous, but it gets excellent results. Been doing it since the 90s. I negotiated for 30 years with the Biggs Unified School District on the teacher side. And now for 6 years, I've been on the school board side here in Palermo, and it's working out wonderfully.
So, Bill Bynum, when did the discussions begin for how to move forward during the pandemic in order to open the schools 5 days a week?
Yeah, we picked that up in August as the school year was looming, and we could see that it was not going to be normal. And so that required both sides to come to the table so we could come up with a memorandum of understanding, an MOU, to put in place so that everybody was in agreement on safety protocols, how to open. We're in a what's called a blended learning model, where students come part-time to school and then part-time they Zoom school. So we do have students at school, but they're not full-time. And that started in August. And then as we moved through the tiers, the red tiers, the purple tiers, we had to come together again and update our MOU to coincide with what was happening in the county and the different protocols that were changing. And then now we're in a situation where the governor wants schools to open full time. The president wants schools to open full time, yet we're still in a purple tier. So we're back at the table. and we are interest-based bargaining how we can get kids in Palermo back to school 5 days a week and still maintain the safety of the teachers and the staff and the students. So it's so it started in August, and we keep updating it, and now we're back in the throes of it.
If you started back in August, it sounds more like an ongoing conversation as opposed to a negotiation where you talk about it, the decision gets made, you move on.
That's exactly right. It's called a living contract. And so back in the old days, every year you would have to, each side would come up with openers. This is what we want to negotiate this year. That's the old adversarial side. And even that was contentious. With a interest-based bargaining system, it's a living contract. So anytime anything comes up, both sides just immediately go to the table, get their common interest and work it out. And it's a marvelous process. We just met last Friday for 6 hours, and there were about 15 of us in the room or on Zoom, and came up with collaboratively 49 options that how we can proceed going forward. And we're only halfway through. We're meeting again tomorrow. We're meeting again next week. And eventually we'll probably have over 100 options, and then we'll start paring that down to what's best for everybody involved. So yeah, it's a living contract.
And it sounds very time consuming. What do you lose in just voting and moving on as opposed to what you pick up in this living negotiation, this constant conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that is the question. And what you lose, and you see everywhere, is you lose trust. So anytime the school board says it's my way or the highway, you automatically create the other side gets their back up and they push back. You have hard feelings. And some of those, I've been in strikes before back in the 80s and 90s, and those hard feelings, they last for decades. They just don't go away. So it's worth all the time and all the effort to maintain trust. And even if you are in interest-based bargaining, if you're not doing that correctly, if you're not being transparent, then it can go sideways. Also, you have to trust the other side. You have to really believe they have everybody's best interests at heart. It's not an easy thing. So we have a wonderful facilitator, Lynn DeArmond, who I negotiated with for, like I say, 30 years. And so he sits at the table with both sides, and he helps each side follow the process. And the saying is, be hard on the issues, but soft on the people. So at the end of every meeting, we go down what went right, what went wrong, what we can improve on. And it's as long as you've got good people on both sides who know the process and who have everybody's best interest at heart, It's a great system. Works wonderfully.
That was Palermo School Board member Bill Bynum. You are listening to the Butte Report on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. Finally, last night, the Vina GSA and Rock Creek Reclamation District held a joint public workshop on the development of the sustainable management criteria for the Vina Groundwater Sustainability Plan. I spoke with Evan Tuschinski, chair of the Vina GSA, and asked him to talk about the purpose of this public meeting as well as the outcome.
We were going over what the sustainable management criteria should be for the Vina subbasin. So what does that mean? We were trying to figure out in the five categories that we're responsible for under SGMA, what the measurements should be, what those thresholds should be that we should worry about, and then what the thresholds we want as our goal should be. Sounds simple, right? Not really, because we have to go with some real complex science on the matter. And we found during the presentation that we got from GeoSyntech, which is the scientific consultant that we're using, that there's a lot of data that's missing. Particularly when it comes to the streams that we have. They consider streams to be any surface flowing water. So essentially here we have kind of Big Chico Creek, Little Chico Creek, and Rock Creek as the big ones. We have to figure out what the baseline is for those, whether they're creeks that gain water, whether they're creeks that lose water to the groundwater system, or whether they're disconnected from the groundwater system entirely. Well, there hasn't been a whole lot of actual hard data study on those. Chico State did a study in 2020 about Big Chico Creek, so we have a pretty good idea what's going on with Big Chico Creek. But even so, we don't have enough hard data where we could set a measurement saying, okay, if Big Chico Creek falls by 5 inches over X period of time, we know there's an issue. So that has a whole lot of holes in it. We also have to figure out what scenarios we want to use for other areas too. The other criteria, there are 6 criteria in total, 5 of them that apply to us. One of them is kind of chronic lowering of groundwater levels. One of them is reduction of storage. One of them is land subsidence. One of them is water quality. And one of them, just as I talked about, was surface water. So the last one is seawater intrusion, and we're not close enough to the sea where we have to worry about seawater intrusion. So we're fortunate in that reduction of storage is basically tied with chronic lowering of the groundwater, so we can measure those at the same time. And subsidence, because of our natural geology here, we aren't prone to having subsidence tied to anything other than groundwater pumping. So those 3 measures we can kind of look at together. And that was the one where we had the most robust discussion. Of our 3.5-hour meeting, we spent 2.5 hours talking about the chronic lowering of groundwater, reduction of storage, and subsidence. So that's kind of the rough overview of what we talked about. Our meeting ended up going 3.5 hours. We had a total of 55 people participating, 10 members of these 2 boards, and then some staff members. But we had roughly 40 members of the community attend the meeting, and a good number of them chime in with questions and concerns and input. So it was a very robust discussion. And at the end of it, there were still 44 people who hung in there for the whole 3.5 hours. So that was great.
In homeless news, the city of Chico has issued its 3rd round of 72-hour eviction notices in the past 2 months, this time focusing on people camping in the area of Wisconsin Avenue and Boucher Street in the Chapmantown neighborhood of South Chico. This new encampment emerged after the homeless encampment at the so-called Triangle was dismantled by Chico police last week. On the back of the written eviction notices, there is a list of resources for people needing assistance. However, many of those listed resources, for example, the tourist shelter and safe space winter shelter, are either non-functioning or are not taking new clients at the moment. However, with the expected storms through the weekend, it is assumed that the encampments will not be moved until the storms pass. Looking forward to next week, the Gridley City Council meets on Monday. On Tuesday, both the Oroville City Council and the Chico City Councils meet. Also on Tuesday, the Vina GSA Stakeholder Advisory Committee will meet from 9 a.m. until noon. And on Wednesday, the Chico School Board and the Gridley School Board and the Paradise Irrigation District Board will meet. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters.